Hi, I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. Imagine you're an entrepreneur, and you want to start a business. You're lean, you're scrappy. You look at the established competitors and you break down the customer experience. What's it like? Where are the pain points? You figure out something you could do better, and that's your in. You make that thing your business plan, and you become a disruptor. It's an old story, really, from film-fed cameras to digital photography, brick-and-mortar to e-commerce, DVDs to streaming. Disruption's just part of the mojo underlying capitalism. You want to be successful? You figure out how to disrupt, or else. Well, today we're going to dive into disruption and talk about those scrappy, lean startups and what legacy businesses can do to keep up. Because, let's face it, if you disrupt and become successful, you become established. And then, someone comes along and tries to disrupt you. Jonah Berger is our guest today. He's a marketing professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and best-selling author of Contagious, Invisible Influence, and The Catalyst. Our conversation's coming up next. Small businesses are ready to thrive again and looking for resources to rise to the challenge. We've teamed up with Dell Technologies to bring you this episode about business disruption. Whether you're still working remotely or back together again, let Dell Technologies help safeguard your business with modern devices and Windows 11 Pro. Jonah Berger, welcome to Business Wars.
Thanks so much for having me.
You help new businesses understand how they can disrupt the market. And, you know, I was thinking about my description there. What's the difference between disruption and, say, just competition? You know, another grocery store enters the marketplace. Some people would say that's a disruption. Certainly the competitor would say that's a disruption. But how do you think of disruption?
Often when we talk about disruption, we're not just talking about competition. We're not just talking about someone offering the same thing that you might be or your organization might. We're really talking about a company coming in and changing the way that business is done, really offering a different product or service, offering the same product or service in a different way, or really solving a problem or addressing a need that might not have been addressed before.
Yeah, I think that's really important because when I think of disruptor, and I think a lot of our listeners think of it, it's like the Ubers of this world, right?
It certainly can be Ubers, and it certainly can be billion-dollar businesses, but there's disruption in almost every area of life. It's all about understanding the customer and really starting there.
Well, let's get started there. What do businesses need to think about when they're thinking about the customer and that sort of, what, customer chain, I guess?
Yeah. Well, let's take some disruptors most of us are probably quite familiar with. Let's take an Uber, for example, or an Airbnb. Mm-hmm. What both of those companies did is they really solved a problem that at least some set of consumers had. In the hotel space, for example, people were dissatisfied with the options that were available. If you were traveling with some friends and you wanted to sort of stay together, it was difficult to do that in a hotel. You didn't really get a chance to interact with the local community, and it wasn't really what everyone was looking for.
Right.
Same with taxi cabs, right? Remember the days if you lived in a big city and it was raining and you wanted to get a cab where you had to walk outside and wait there on the corner avoid the puddles. And that wasn't a lot of fun. And so what companies like Uber, like Airbnb did is they came in and they solved the underlying problem. They didn't necessarily offer the same product or service, but they understood that customer need and created something that solved a pain point for at least some of those customers out there.
Let's take another example. One that comes to mind are those Warby Parker online eyeglasses. I can remember, and it used to be, that it was impossible to buy eyeglasses from anywhere, except, of course, one of the lens crafters, or before that, Pearl Optical. I don't know if any of our listeners remember Pearl Optical or Pearl Vision Centers as they became. But what did Warby Parker do? What was the pain point that they spotted and that they ran with?
So I think Warby's a great example for a couple reasons. And the first is because we usually, when we think about disruption, we think it's all about technology, right? Even the way you just described Warby Parker, you said, they're an internet company, right? They're going to deliver glasses online rather than doing physical stores. And disruptors are certainly often technology enabled. But the technology itself isn't always the disruption. Often it's understanding that consumer pain point. Technology helps solve the problem, but the understanding really comes from the pain point itself. You know, sure, Warby's allows people to buy glasses online and they're a great organization, but the big problem that they solved was that glasses were just way more expensive than they needed to be. Right? The Warby guys actually came out of Wharton, and a few of them were in my class a number of years ago. And one of them had worked in the eyewear world and had worked in the developing world, actually helping people get glasses in the developing world. And they realized, wow, you know, there are these glasses that come off production lines that can be delivered in the developing world for a really small amount of money, coming off right next to these super expensive pairs of glasses from Armani Exchange or Prada, whatever it is. And they said, well, why do glasses need to cost so much? They don't need to cost so much. Mm-hmm. Can we suck out some of those costs and deliver a better customer experience along the way? And so, sure, yes, they delivered that experience through online rather than physical stores, in part as a way to save money. Though now, if you've noticed, they've moved into physical stores. They have hundreds of stores across the United States because their solution isn't online rather than stores. Their solution is sucking out some of those costs and delivering a high value, great customer experience to those customers.
But it's interesting that you should, and I think this is worth underscoring. We're talking about how disruption is more than just tech. That's sort of an important point, I think, because you've probably had these conversations, I know I have, with people who are entrepreneurially driven. They want to create the next big thing, and they quite often begin with their smartphone. They think, what kind of app can I create that will sort of solve a problem? But as you're pointing out, maybe that's not the right question.
Yeah, I would take the words you said and turn them in a slightly different order. What is a problem that needs to be solved? And then, right, how can I go ahead and solve that problem? I work with lots of early stage startups, and I can't tell you how many say something along the lines of, we've got this new thing. We've been able to do this thing technology-wise. It's never been done before. Mm. It's going to be super successful. And I say, oh, that's really interesting, but you know, does anyone need it? Does it solve a problem that people have?
Right.
And you know, the world is littered with amazing technologies that never caught on. Whether it's the Segway, though now part of the Segway's technology is in some other things we use, or whether you think of Google Glass or whatever technology you like, it's not about the technology first and the customer second. It's about the customer first and their needs. And then if technology helps us, wonderful. But even if technology doesn't, if we solve that need, people are going to be happy.
Well, let's talk about the advantages and perhaps disadvantages that disruptors have that perhaps legacy businesses don't. I mean, maybe let's begin with the advantages.
You know, I think we think about disruptors and we say, oh my God, they're so disadvantaged, right? They're so small. No one's heard of them before. They don't have any money. But actually, some of those things can be advantages, right? The challenge of being in a large organization with a very successful product or service is people don't want to kill their cash cow. Right. If you work at a hotel chain and, you know, your hotel is very successful, or you work for a taxi business and it's going pretty well, there's not a lot of incentive to change. Right. Everything new seems risky and uncertain. Why would I get away from doing what we're already doing when it's working so well? And maybe even we're you know, not doing as well as we used to, but we're still doing pretty well. Even if, you know, market share is down 1% a year, there's not a big incentive to change. Whereas if you're small, if you have no customers, if you have a little bit of runway, you know, a little bit of venture money, but not that much, you've got a lot of incentive to change things. Because if you don't change things and don't change them fast, mm-hmm. you're going to be out of business.
Well, if disruption is driven by the customer, as you're saying, let's talk through some other examples of how companies have used tech and perhaps have tried to use tech to change the marketplace for consumers. I mean, you mentioned the Segway, which I thought was a really interesting, perhaps salient example, because I can remember the hype that surrounded this idea of a gyroscopically sort of driven or balanced scooter, perhaps changing transportation as we knew it. Of course, you only see those at the shopping mall by and large these days. What failed, and what is it that, I guess, what, consumers weren't looking for it, but they weren't looking for Uber either?
Well, they weren't looking for Uber, but they were looking for something like Uber, right? They wished that a problem had gone away. And actually, so I teach marketing at the Wharton School. We talk a lot about market research, and people often brush off qualitative research, say, oh, why would I do qualitative research? Quantitative research is much better. Mm-hmm. And quantitative research is really good, but people talk about need finding or sort of pain point identification. And often that starts in a really qualitative way. And if you follow people around, right, you follow a family doing their cooking, you follow a business person trying to get a ride somewhere, you follow any individual going through their lives, you can see some of their pain points. They may not be able to tell you, hey, I'd like Uber to exist, or hey, I want Airbnb to exist. But if you follow enough hotel customers and you ask them, what aren't you satisfied about? You'll get some answers that you can use to build a new product or service. And so it's really identifying those needs that helps those small companies succeed.
And that gets to your point about Google Glasses, I suppose. I mean, this was a neat thing that technology could do, but it wasn't like you had a lot of people saying, gee, I wish I could call up my contacts at the corner of my eye without anybody else knowing that it was happening. I mean, just, is that what you're talking about here when you say this, the consumer comes first?
Sure. I mean, take even an example of, think about Netflix. We think about the current incarnation of Netflix, but think actually about the original incarnation of Netflix. And so, you know, I remember when I was a kid, if it was Friday night or Saturday night, my family would go to the video store. It'd be a big event, right? Mm-hmm. We'd all pile in the station wagon. We'd go through the aisles of the Blockbuster. Actually, we didn't go to Blockbuster, but the local video store we had, and we'd pick a video. And why did we go to the store to pick a video? Well, that's where the videos were, right? They weren't at our house. But then one of my parents, or maybe we'd be tagging along, would have to bring it back to the video store. And so it was two trips to the store to watch a video. And so the original incarnation of Netflix was exactly that, was solving exactly that pain point, right? Look, you don't need to drive to the video store anymore. Go online, look for the videos you want, in this case, DVDs, we'll send them directly to your house. And that was good for a little while, right? And that really put a big dent in Blockbuster's business and the video business, because it solved a problem. But then there was another problem that came up, right? Which is people said, well, wait, I want to watch this video now.
Now.
I don't want to wait 2 or 3 days for it to become mailed to my house. I want to watch it now. I'm going to go to whoever's going to offer me that thing. And so Netflix didn't sit there and say, oh, you know what? We have a bigger selection, or, oh, we're going to lower our prices. They blew up their existing business model, right? They were really good at mailing people DVDs. That was their entire business model. And they killed it. Right. And so they realize, and this is something I think if you look at smart legacy businesses that end up being successful, mm-hmm. is end up cannibalizing themselves. They end up saying, I'm not going to wait for someone else out there to come in and beat up my business. I'm going to say, hey, what do people want? And I'm going to come up with the new generation of what I'm offering even before the competition does, so that I can stay in the position of power.
You know, I was thinking about what actually was the tipping point for e-commerce in particular. And, you know, because obviously going to the malls used to be part of the American experience for decades. And when e-commerce began, you had to change a lot of people's weekend mall habits. What would you describe as the tipping point? Amazon comes to mind initially, but I suppose there were other players too.
Yeah, I would say there are a couple things that really enabled e-commerce. So one was certainly selection. Right. If you think about it, many people who lived in many areas of the country didn't have the range of options that someone who lived in a downtown major metropolitan area might have.
Sure.
And so part of what the internet offered was just selection for a large set of consumers. You could get many things that you couldn't get before. If you look at the business Wayfair, that's actually very successful today.
Yeah.
They started as a series of kind of one-off websites, you know, one selling bird cages, one selling TV stands, one selling other things, where they just had more selection than anyone else had. But in addition to selection, one of the things that really enabled e-commerce to go was free shipping. And that's because people were interested in ordering things online, but they didn't want to have to pay for the privilege of doing so, right? Mm-hmm. Yes, some people like going to the mall, and some people still like going to the mall. They like browsing. But for many consumers, they either know what they want or have some sense of what they want. They don't have to deal with parking. They don't have to deal with finding the right size and all those different things. And so Zappos was actually one of the companies that really started doing free shipping initially. And they realized people didn't want to pay for the privilege of getting stuff online. They said, well, what could we make a showroom? Well, we could make your living room a showroom, right? If we give you free shipping, you'll order 3 or 4 pairs. They'll show up. Your living room will become your very own showroom. You can try them on. Sure, you're going to send back some of those pairs. You're not going to keep them all, but you'll end up ordering a lot more shoes than if we had forced you to pay for shipping up front. And that really enabled e-commerce to go.
Jonah Berger is our guest today. He's a marketing professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and best-selling author of Contagious, Invisible Influence, and The Catalyst. We've been talking about how a scrappy upstart can disrupt the major players, but when we come back, we're going to explore how established or legacy businesses can respond to disruption. Stay with us.
We get support from Dell Technologies and their Small Business Podference. You know, small businesses are ready to thrive again, and they're looking for resources to rise to the challenge. That's why Dell Technologies has assembled an all-star lineup of podcasters for the third year in a row to create a virtual conference to share advice and inspiration for small businesses. Whether you're still working remotely or back together again, let Dell Technologies help safeguard your business with modern devices and Windows 11 Pro. And search Dell Technologies Small Business Podference on Odyssey.com, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts starting May 10th.
Welcome back to Business Wars. I'm David Brown, and we're talking with Jonah Berger. He is marketing professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And the subject is disruption in business, how it's done, and if you're an established business, how to respond to it. Now, I know, Jonah, you also help legacy organizations avoid being disrupted or at least deal with disruption. So if you are one of those businesses and this is happening to you, well, what are your options?
You know, there's a great saying that goes something along the lines of what got you here won't get you there. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the challenge of being a successful sort of legacy organization, right? You've done so many things so well to get to the place where you are today that you have a tendency not to want to change. The problem is that the marketplace is always changing. Customer needs are always changing. Expectations are always changing. And if you're not meeting those pain points, someone else is going to meet those customer needs and satisfy them. And so if you look at businesses, legacy organizations that have done a good job dealing with this, one thing they often do is they often set up an internal skunkworks or sort of an independent team to reimagine business in this particular space. So at Google, for example, they have a group called ATAP, which I think stands for like advanced technology and projects. Zappos has a part of the organization like this. A number of organizations have kind of an internal team who are not at all connected to the main products and services. And the expectation is not that they're going to make those products and services better. Their expectation is actually, you're going to look at the marketplace like an outsider would, like a startup would, like a disruptor would, but disrupt from the internal perspective, right? You're still within our business. You can come up with a competitor to our main line of business. But if we don't have that internal team who's doing that, there's no way that's going to happen.
You know, I don't want to focus so much on Netflix and Blockbuster, although when we did our series on Netflix versus Blockbuster, something that really stood out to me was exactly what the sort of thinking that you're talking about trying to avoid. Blockbuster, as you're probably aware, when they saw Netflix starting to rise, they pretty much decided, well, not sure if this is going to go, but we're going to hedge our bets and we're going to basically copy them. They copied the look of Netflix, except theirs, of course, was blue and yellow. I don't know if anyone remembers, but it was so obviously a copy that I think that some customers began to think, wait a minute, if Blockbuster is copying Netflix, they're doing something right. And that's a danger, I guess. In a way, what you're doing is you're tipping your hat to someone who's providing a superior service to what you had been in the market doing in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple of problems with that approach, right? And first, often companies that copy what other companies are doing are copying what I'll call the surface features of what that company is doing, the look, the feel, the idea of what they're offering, without necessarily understanding why that company is doing what they're doing. And that's really the challenge, right? And this happens with any sort of program. You know, I'll often have clients that say, hey, we want to do a loyalty program, but we tried it and it didn't work. Well, there are many versions you can have of a loyalty program, for example. If you don't understand why a loyalty program works, just copying someone else's program isn't necessarily going to be successful for you, right? If I'm Blockbuster, I'm saying, well, let me just do something that looks like Netflix, but I'm not really solving that underlying pain point, it's unlikely to be successful. But I think the second challenge sometimes is people have expectations of these legacy businesses, right? I think of Blockbuster for a certain type of thing. And so I'm less likely to think about them as an innovative company that might be able to solve this other problem that I might have. And so you almost need stepping stones or sort of a bridge to move people people towards a new offering like that. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't seem like something completely new. It seems like an integration with their existing experience. But sometimes, you know, if a legacy company offers something, people just assume it's not going to be good because the things they've done in the past may not have been so innovative.
So don't be a copycat. that's maybe one takeaway.
The short answer, yes.
Especially if you don't really understand the underlying dynamics of what the competitive disruptor is doing. So what are some of the other common pitfalls that legacy businesses may not completely understand?
Yeah, you know, I think we talked a little bit before about that idea of killing your own business and that the unwillingness to do so. I think another thing, though, a big challenge that people feel is that innovation is really big and risky, and we've got to sort of do it whole hog, right? So I'm a company, I'm thinking about letting a new product out there, a new service out there, but it's going to be really expensive to do it all. And so, you know, we should just do nothing. And I think what really smart companies are able to do is they're able to de-risk innovation, right? They're able to figure out ways to sort of take small bets and test and learn, and use that feedback to design the next version of what they're doing. So I'll give a great example of this from the smart folks over at Warby Parker. So they had been an online-only business for a long time, and they were thinking of opening up stores. And the challenge with opening up stores is you got to figure out, well, where am I going to open up a store? Right? And you say, oh, New York City. Well, okay, great. But New York City is really big, right? Where in New York City are you going to open up a store? And by the way, that's not a costless decision because you got to enter in a contract. That contract likely has many years to it. You've got to retrofit a space unless the person you lease it from is going to do that for you. It's a big cost to decide where to locate those new stores. And so they were trying to figure out, well, what can we do to de-risk this process, to make it less risky for us? And so they bought an old school bus. They got rid of most of the seats, and they made it essentially a traveling showroom. And so this bus would go around to major cities, driving around town, parking on certain corners for a few hours, and selling glasses. Now, most people said, what is this big yellow school bus doing? They realized it was selling eyewear. It seemed interesting. They walked on, they checked it out, and not everybody, but some people bought glasses. Now, a cynical person would look at this and say, oh, this is just a pop-up, right? I mean, what's creative about this? It sort of got some buzz, but what are they learning from this? But it was actually very strategic, because they weren't just trying to do something clever or funny or interesting. They were trying to figure out, well, where in the city is a good place to open a store? And so some days we'll park here, some days we'll park there, and we'll keep track of how many people are coming in, as well as how many people are trying things and buying things. And we'll use that information to help us figure out where to locate a store. Now, is buying a bus free? No. Is retrofitting it with all the, you know, stuff you need to sell eyewear free? Certainly not.
But
it's a lot cheaper than selling that big lease at a physical location. Absolutely. And you can learn a lot from it. And so that's a nice way to de-risk innovation.
Absolutely. I know you consult with a lot of organizations like Google, Apple, Nike, and all of these successful enterprises. They have to be looking over their shoulder and thinking about how they avoid disruption in the first place. What would you tell an established legacy company if they're looking to try to avoid disruption? How do you set up those mirrors at the right angles so that you can see a disruptor coming? Or do you always have to be on the offensive?
I think it's less worrying about the disruptor and more worrying about your customer. Right. You know, we talk a lot in marketing about competition and being aware of competition. And, you know, sometimes you hear these stories of Uber did such and such to Lyft and so on. But smart businesses aren't as worried about the competition. They're worried about their customers. Right. If your competition is out there, whatever they're doing, unless they're meeting customer needs, it's unlikely they're going to succeed. And so it's not the competition per se you need to be worried about. It's your customer. Right. Are you making your customer happy? Are you satisfying them? Are you meeting their needs? Are there needs of theirs that aren't met, right? And often we do a little exercise in my class where we talk about defining competition. And I find this exercise both to be extremely obvious, but also deeply interesting. So you ask students, for example, well, hey, who's Ford's competition? People sit there and they think about it and they go, oh, Chevy. And I say, okay, well, why Chevy? And they say, well, because Chevy's an American car company, as is Ford, and they make trucks as well as cars. And so they're sort of Ford's competition. And if you ask them again, who else is Ford's competition? They'll say, well, maybe Toyota, even though they're not American made, they're a competitor, they make a similar thing. And then I ask something like, well, is Uber Ford's competition? And they sit there and they think about it a minute. And some people go, yes. And some people go, no. And the folks that go, no, they say, well, what do you mean Uber's? I mean, Uber doesn't make cars. How is Uber their competition? But the folks who say yes, and these are the folks that are actually sort of right, are the ones that realize that, hey, competitors aren't about a company that makes the same thing you make. Competitors are about companies or organizations that satisfy the same needs that you satisfy. There's a nice framework called the jobs to be done framework, which says, you know, customers buy products and services to do jobs, right? I buy a car to let me buy groceries, for example, pick them up and take them home. I buy a hotel room because I'm in a city away from home and I need a place to stay. People aren't sitting there going, well, I want to buy a hotel room from a hotel chain, or I want to get my groceries with the help of a car company. They're sitting there going, well, I have this need and I need to solve it. I have a problem. I need to solve it. They don't care who solves it. And so sure, is Uber the competitor of, you know, Ford's heavy duty truck division? Probably not, right? You know, if I need to move a lot of heavy machinery and Uber's not going to solve that
yeah,
problem.
Right.
But is Uber the competition of the small cars that Ford makes that go around in the city? Certainly. Right? Maybe those people decide they don't need cars. And so don't define that competition too narrowly. See it as who solves the same problem rather than who just makes the same thing.
We talked about the advantages of being a disruptor. What about the advantages, are there any, of being a legacy company? I mean, maybe brand recognition, perhaps?
I mean, there are a lot of advantages to being a legacy organization, right? First, you do have that brand recognition. Customers know you. They've heard of you before. You also have a lot of resources. Right? You're usually profitable, which means if you invest those profits well in R&D, you can figure out what's coming down the pike. And you also have teams that know a lot about a space. That knowledge, though, can be a double-edged sword, right? If you've been in an industry so long, yes, you have great relationships. Suppliers trust you and you have good partners and collaborators, but maybe your teams are so used to seeing an area a certain way that it's hard for them to see it or to think differently. And that's really where someone with a more outside perspective can sometimes be helpful.
I was going to say, because it almost seems like this approach might require a different sort of psychology that you would need as someone running a business, that a legacy company would need to adapt to changes and to take advantage of those pain points, if you will. Is that right or no?
I think certainly the ability to see things with new eyes is key. That's the wonderful thing about being a kid is the same way, right? You really, as a kid, you don't have all that knowledge, and it allows you to see new things that others might not see. And so I think you really have to bring that type of insight to your organization. Either you have to bring people in from the outside who don't have the biases from folks who've been in the industry forever. You need to bring in consultants who don't have those biases, or you need to engage in exercises and perspective taking to help you see things from an outsider's perspective.
Now, maybe this is something that requires some time in the class with you, but I'm thinking about the fact that a lot of legacy companies in particular have a lot of built-in constituencies, right? There may be shareholders. There may be people who were the founders of the organization who are clinging to their positions. Who knows? There are countless constituencies once you get a company up and running. How do you get past the hesitation or the uncertainty to take on new things inside a company?
This is certainly a big challenge. And you often see this with family-run businesses or sort of founder-led businesses, right? They've built a business from nothing to be hugely successful. And it's hard for them to imagine anyone else could know more about that business than them. And the challenge is that the marketplace has changed and they were very right at one point in time, but they're not necessarily still right. They don't necessarily still have that edge or that beneficial perspective. And so I think that's really where an outside perspective with seeing things with fresh eyes, understanding their customers, really putting yourself in the customer's shoes, it is so powerful. But it requires understanding change. My most recent book, The Catalyst, is all about this, right? And really dealing with the status quo bias, right? We have a bias to stick with the way things that have always been, whether it's a product, a service, whether it's within an organization, how we do business. We tend to go with it. It's not broke, don't fix it, right? And so what I talk a lot about in that book is really how can we identify the barriers to change and how can we mitigate them? Not pushing people more, right? Not providing more facts or information or reasons, but understanding what the barriers are and helping remove them.
At the same time, I suppose you can imagine this happening. You're sitting in a boardroom and you're making this pitch and there are people who point to Amazon with Whole Foods, or Warby Parker, you know, which has gone into having retail stores. I think they now have something like 150 locations. You see there, brick and mortar is still with us. And how do you explain what's happening with something like that, where you have a disruptor who seems to be doing something counter to that original vision?
We do another exercise in the class that I teach. We talk about what are stores for? This is an extremely, both seemingly obvious on the surface question, but really deep and interesting question, right? It's clear what stores used to be for. Stores used to be for finding merchandise and purchasing it and taking it home, right? That used to be the only way that could occur.
Yeah.
But now we can do much of that on the internet. And so what's neat is what smart companies are really doing is they're saying, well, what's a store good for? Right? Take a company like Bonobos, for example. They have these guide shops where you show up, you can try on clothes, mm-hmm. but you actually can't pick them up from the store, right? If you're interested in a particular pair of pants or shirt, you can buy it on a given day, but they're not going to give it to you that day. They're going to say, great, we're going to ship it to your house. They use the stores as an opportunity to see the array of stuff they have, touch it, feel it, see how well it fits someone, but saves all that backroom space that would have cost a lot of money by shipping it to people's homes and also getting them used to buying the stuff online and having it shipped to them. And so I think what smart companies are doing is they're saying, how can we use these tools effectively rather than how can we use them just because they're there?
Jonah Berger is a marketing professor at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, and he's best-selling author of Contagious, Invisible Influence, and most recently, The Catalyst. Jonah, thanks so much for taking time to talk with us on Business Wars. It's been a real delight.
Thanks so much for having me.
From Wondery, this is Business Wars. I'm your host, David Brown. Polly Stryker and Peter Arcuni produced this episode. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Edited and produced by Emily Frost. Sound design by Kyle Randall. Additional audio assistance by Sergio Enriquez. Dave Schilling is our producer. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louie. Created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
We get support from Dell Technologies and their small business podference. You know, small businesses are ready to thrive again, and they're looking for resources to rise to the challenge. That's why Dell Technologies has assembled an all-star lineup of podcasters for the third year in a row to create a virtual conference to share advice and inspiration for small businesses. Whether you're still working remotely or back together again, let Dell Technologies help safeguard your business with modern devices and Windows 11 Pro. And search Dell Technologies Small Business Podference on Odyssey.com, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts starting May 10th.